Welcome to Citizen Shift, episode 77, Taking the Risk for Change. I'm Tim McSorley. Howard Zinn is a teacher, historian, and author. He is perhaps best known for his groundbreaking book, A People's History of the United States. He is also a longtime civil rights and peace activist. At 86 years old, Zinn continues to provide fresh insight into American politics and social movements by drawing on the lessons of our past. Journalist Evan Light spoke to Howard Zinn during a recent visit to Montreal. In their conversation, Zinn speaks to not only what the election of America's first black president represents, but also the work still needed to improve equality and justice in the United States.
The election of Obama certainly is evidence that there has been some change in the racial climate in the United States. And I could see, even in the short time that I was in the South, that is, I lived in the South for 7 years, but those were very critical years in the late 50s and early 60s. And even in those 7 years, I could already see the possibilities for change in that long ingrained, deep ingrained racism in the United States, because I could see white people beginning to rethink what they had grown up with, feelings they had grown up with, the things they had been taught by, you know, by parents, by church, by society around them. And so if I could see that kind of change in 7 years, then I can certainly imagine over a longer period of time, an even deeper change. And in fact, that change has occurred. Obama could not have been elected. No black person could have been elected to the presidency 30 years ago. And the fact that Obama was elected shows what the possibilities are. Now, whether there will be some very fundamental societal change in the United States really depends on whether there's a new social movement in the United States that demands it, because it's not going to come simply from Obama. Obama is very much, you know, although he represents a departure in the matter of race, he does not represent much of a departure in the matter of social and economic policy or foreign policy. His inclination is to do what Democratic candidates in the past have done. He does not seem in many ways in his policies much different, let us say, from Bill Clinton. And so it will take, I think, a combination of crisis in foreign policy, crisis in the economy, a combination of those crises and the emergence or the reawakening of a social movement in the United States to really bring about any serious change. Now, whether that will happen depends on whether the economic crisis deepens, whether the problems abroad deepen, that is, the wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and whether the American people decide that they absolutely must act in order to prevent either economic disaster, you know, or, you know, a continuation of war. So, you know, it's all up in the air, dependent on a number of factors which we can't predict. In the United States, we do not have fascism, but of course we have a state which represses dissent, and depending on the time, you know, has different degrees of coercion in trying to keep down popular opposition. But I think it is possible in the United States to create a movement which goes beyond legal restrictions and yet is short of, let us say, guerrilla warfare, you know, weathermen people, bombings and so on. Not only don't I believe it's necessary, I probably believe it's counterproductive, and that in the United States it might very well be possible to have a movement which engages in direct action, which commits civil disobedience, which goes so far as to commit violence against property in the way that people did during the Vietnam War when they barged into draft boards and tore up draft records and, you know, in other words, the kinds of things that strikes do when they take over property or when they interfere with strike breakers, which, you know, I consider sort of a minimum degree of violence. But I think that it is possible to bring about social change if you organize enough people to disobey the edicts of government. That is, if you organize enough workers to go on strike, if you organize enough consumers to boycott the corporations, if you organize enough soldiers to refuse to fight in war, then you don't have to engage in violence in order to bring about social change, because the power of the establishment, the power of the government, the power of corporations, is dependent on the obedience of people. Once that obedience is withdrawn, you know, once people refuse to work, refuse to serve in the military, refuse to buy products, once that obedience is withdrawn, then I think the apparently powerful people become helpless. So we have seen people go on strike and win what they wanted without violence. And we've seen changes come about in the South, and I certainly saw them, of the very determined white supremacists yielding when they were facing a population which they could not control. I think it is possible to steer some kind of course between a sort of polite legal opposition and outright violence. Try to figure out how change takes place. It is useful to go back in the history and see how it happens. And I suppose you might say I was in a position to see how it happened in the South, because I was there before the rise of the sit-ins and the freedom rides and the big demonstrations. I came to Atlanta, Georgia, in the Deep South when things seemed very quiet and there was no real movement. There had been the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955, just before I arrived in the South in 1956. But after the Montgomery bus boycott, things seemed to be rather quiet. And then I could watch the growth of a movement. And the question is, exactly how does it take place? And it takes place, I think, because, first of all, there already exists in the population beneath the surface of their actions, which may be non-existent, between the under the surface of passivity, there is a resentment against their situation. This was certainly true of black people in the South. They didn't have to be aroused. They didn't have to be persuaded that something was wrong. They knew something was wrong, but they felt helpless to do anything about it. And what happened is that the first sort of daring forays against the establishment took place, which gave courage to other people. That is, when those young people in Greensboro, North Carolina, in February of 1960, sat in Woolworth's counter and refused to leave. And then the photos were shown all over the country and around the world. And young people, and I could see it happening where I was, in this very quiet black women's college where I taught, and where things were seemed very controlled. You could see them looking at the television screen, seeing what happens in Greensboro, North Carolina, and deciding, well, we're going to get together, we're going to organize, we're going to meet and see if we can do the same thing here. And the same thing was happening in other places in the South. What happens, I think, is that people who feel powerless remain powerless until somebody takes the initiative, somebody steps out in front, somebody takes the risk, and then other people watch and they see that although other people who've taken that risk may have been immediately shot down, they see a situation where somebody's taken a risk and they aren't immediately shot down. They have an effect. Their voice is heard. And so they decide, yes, it's possible. It's possible to speak up and to act and to protest and possibly win. And so the idea spreads. And, of course, the more people resist the existing order, the more encouragement there is to others. So I think it's a matter of people beginning to feel their power, to feel their potency. It's it happens in other movements. It happens in the labor movement. When workers see that it's possible to go on strike and win, after a history in which people who protest against their working conditions are simply fired, when they see it's possible to organize and win, well, then they go ahead and do it. And I saw the same thing happen because I was in the same position coming up north after my time in the South, coming up north at the time of the beginning of the escalation of the Vietnam War. And I could see the growth of the anti-war movement and how people did feel, how can we stop a war? And yet, people began to act. People began to protest, and with very, very dim hopes of succeeding. But as more and more people protested and encouraged one another, the movement grew. So I think that overcoming that feeling of powerlessness is very, very crucial. And the setting of examples is very crucial. The inspiring of other people by the actions of an intrepid few. We have a tradition in the United States, even though that tradition is so often violated, but we have a tradition and a belief in the idea of freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. And so we don't have as far to go in retrieving that as people have had to go in other countries where they didn't have that sort of historical grounding. So I think here in the United States, it's a matter of people really resting on a tradition, a constitutional tradition. Everybody knows about the Bill of Rights. Everybody thinks that they should have these rights. And they've been violated, and especially in the Bush administration. And people have, I think, not been happy with that, but they haven't felt capable of fighting against it. There has been intimidation and fear, and it may be that, well, hopefully, with a new administration, there'll be at least a sort of an opening for people to feel freer. There'll be less draconian measures. I'm hopeful that the Patriot Act, and other legislation from the Bush administration, which have suppressed freedom of speech, will be done away with, so I think it is possible for the American people to enter into a freer period of open expression. faced great obstacles in the United States to reforming the political system. The role of money, and you might say so long as money dominates in society, so long as corporate money dominates every aspect of the society, it will dominate elections. So it's a very tough job to change this political system, which discourages third parties and makes it very, very difficult for parties other than the Democratic parties to gain power. So I think it would be a long struggle to change that situation. And it might have to happen state by state, because it's the individual states that set up barriers. One of the reasons why third-party candidates have a hard time. Each state has its own requirements for getting on the ballot and having some visibility to the public. And so it will take a state-by-state movement to change those rules and allow third parties to get on the ballot. And I think it will take a national movement to overcome this monopoly of media time, which happens whenever there's a presidential election, and they do not allow anybody but a Republican or Democrat to get up there and debate. So I'm afraid it will be a long struggle to change that.
That was professor, activist, historian, and author Howard Zinn, interviewed by Evan Light. You've been listening to Citizen Shift. You can read more by Howard Zinn at howardzinn.org. To comment on or discuss the ideas Howard Zinn brought up in this podcast, visit citizen.nfb.ca and click on Podcasts on the right-hand side of the page. A quick programming note before we end this episode. We're always accepting new podcast submissions for Citizen Shift. If you have an idea for a story for Citizen Shift, visit our podcast page at citizen.nfb.ca/podcast or email citizen@nfb.ca. I'm Tim McSorley, and this was episode 77 of the Citizen Shift podcast. Thanks for listening.